United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Taipei residents like hospital worker Cheng Yu Lin were rattled Wednesday morning after a strong earthquake offshore Taiwan with a magnitude of 7.2 struck the island, knocking out power in several parts of the capital. State media said it was the strongest quake to hit the island in 25 years. It triggered a tsunami warning in Japan that was later lifted. U.S. and other world leaders continue to react to an Israeli airstrike that killed World Central Kitchen Aid workers from Australia, Britain, and Poland. VOA's Cindy Sain has more in that story.
Standing with his French counterpart on a visit to Paris, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called the aid workers heroes who must be protected.
We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, and impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened.
French Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourné was more direct in condemning the Israeli strike. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said attacks on the aid workers in Gaza were unconscionable after the Israeli airstrike had killed seven people working for World Central Kitchen.
It demonstrates yet again the urgent need for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, and the expansion of humanitarian aid into Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Tuesday that the airstrike mistakenly killed the air workers. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Officials say that Ukrainian drones have attacked a major oil refinery and a drone factory in the province of Tatarstan, and it appears to be one of the Kyiv's deepest strikes inside Russian territory since the war began more than 2 years ago. Meanwhile, diplomats say that NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has proposed a 100 billion euro or $107 billion five-year package of military aid to Ukraine that would give the Western alliance a more direct role in providing support to Kyiv. On a call Tuesday, President Joe Biden discussed with Chinese President Xi Jinping a range of high-level issues and reiterated his request that China not use web-based disinformation tools to interfere with the U.S. presidential election. The two leaders also discussed Taiwan, the island China claims, as it prepares to inaugurate a new leader next month. A company that provides services for immigrants in federal detention has been ordered to pay more than $811 million in restitution and penalties in the lawsuit alleging it used deceptive and abusive tactics. A judgment filed Tuesday in federal court says that Nexus Services must pay restitution to federal authorities and penalties to New York, Virginia, and Massachusetts. It must also pay more than $111 million in civil penalties. State and federal officials say the company promised to secure immigrants' release on bond, but concealed and misrepresented the true nature and cost of its services. The company said in a statement that it intends to appeal that judgment. Donald Trump has again used language denounced by Democrats to hammer President Joe Biden over his handling of the U.S.-Mexico border as he campaigned in two Midwestern swing states likely to be critical to the outcome of the 2024 election. Trump on Tuesday was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Green Bay, Wisconsin, where he rallied against what he called Biden border's bloodbath. He has been leaning into inflammatory rhetoric about the record surge of migrants at the southern border since he became his party's presumptive nominee. Trump and Biden, or said Biden, has brought the carnage and chaos and killing from all over the world and dumped it straight into our backyards. Recapping one of our top stories, the tsunami threat from a strong earthquake that struck Taiwan is largely past. The Japan Meteorological Agency downgraded its forecast from 9.8 feet to 3.3 feet. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, April 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Bassirou Diomaye Faye is sworn in as Senegal's fifth president.
Devant Dieu et devant la nation.
The new president said, before God and the Senegalese nation, I swear that I will fulfill the office of president of the Republic of Senegal faithfully.
Gabon opens a national dialogue to return the country to civilian rule. Sudanese refugees in South Sudan urge warring parties in Sudan to silence the guns. Somalia's semi-autonomous state of Puntland has withdrawn from the country's federal system. A court ruling paved the way for a possible arrest of South Africa's Speaker of Parliament.
Effectively, after a death judgment, it will be up to the police or the National Prosecuting Authority to decide how they are going to effect the arrest.
And the U.S. is outraged over Israeli airstrike that killed 7 workers. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. New Senegalese president Bassirou Diomaye Faye has appointed firebrand politician and key backer Ousmane Sonko as prime minister in his first act as president. Reuters reported late Tuesday. Sonko, an opponent of former president Macky Sall, is popular among Senegal's youth, but was barred from the March 24 presidential election due to a defamation conviction. He denied any wrongdoing. Meanwhile, Bassirou Diomaye Faye was sworn in on Tuesday as Senegal's newest president after winning the delayed presidential election with over 54% of the vote. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Mariama Diallo, attended the ceremony in the capital, Dakar, and has this story.
Bassirou Diomaye Faye was sworn in Tuesday as Senegal's fifth president at the CICAD, the International Conference Center named after the country's second president, located in Jamnyadjo, about an hour from Dakar's city center.
Devant Dieu et devant la nation,
the new president said, before God and the Senegalese nation, I swear that I will fulfill the office of President of the Republic of Senegal faithfully, that I will thoroughly observe and ensure the observance of the provisions of the Constitution and the laws. In his first speech after the swearing-in ceremony, President Faye reassured the people who elected him that he's ready to move his country forward.
Je suis conscient que les résultats sortis des urnes,
he said, I understand the election results show a profound desire for a systemic change. By electing me, the Senegalese people have chosen to build a country that is just, prosper, and within an Africa that is in progress. In his goal of building a new Senegal, Faye said, I will work tirelessly to preserve the peace and national cohesion. In attendance, many dignitaries, including presidents of neighboring Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, Sierra Leone, Gambia, Ghana, Nigeria, and other high-level officials from other African nations. At 44, Diomaye Faye is the youngest man ever to be elected Senegal's president. Maimouna Diaye leads the women's wing of the opposition party PASTEF, led by Ousmane Sonko, who was seen as a key challenger to outgoing President Macky Sall and who backed the new elected president. She's been working with Faye the past 10 years. She said, not a lot of experience in the field of running a country, but he has a lot of experience in his field. He spent 15 years as a tax inspector and occupied many jobs with a lot of responsibilities. She says she knows President Faye will deliver on the vision he expressed during the campaign, where he had proposed solutions to the everyday problems of ordinary Senegalese. Jean-Charles Biagi, researcher and political science professor at the Cheikh Anta Diop University of Dakar, says it'll be important for this new government to make some changes right away. He says, I think the image this new administration, which wanted to break with the old system, would want to have is to drastically reduce the advantages associated with government officials' lifestyle in general, so that the ordinary Senegalese can see that those who are running the country are serving the country and not serving themselves. Biagi also says that whether it starts with this president or not, it's time to think about what constitutes good governance. He said good governance is about assessments, and the governance of the past few decades have given little to no assessments. I think increasingly Senegalese people want their leader to account for what they've done. They should all be audited after they leave office. Meanwhile, many of the new president's supporters who witnessed the swearing-in are hopeful the tensions of the last few months will fade away to be replaced by the hope that their country's reputation as a beacon of democracy in West Africa is restored. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Gabon's National Dialogue called to pave the way for a return to constitutional order and an end to a 55-year Bongo dynasty began in the Central African state on Tuesday. Opposition and civil groups are taking part, but some are concerned that the current military ruler, General Brice Oligui Nguema, will use the conference to cement a grip on power. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Transitional President General Brice Oligui Nguema opened the dialogue Tuesday, telling a crowd of several thousand civilians and soldiers that Gabon's citizens are looking forward to what is billed as the country's inclusive major national dialogue. During the ceremony at the Libreville Sports Complex, broadcast live on Gabon State TV, Oligui said he expects the head of the dialogue, Catholic Archbishop Jean-Patrick Ibarba, to come up with a roadmap that will determine the duration of the transitional government. Oligui has ruled Gabon since the military ousted President Ali Ben Bongo in a bloodless coup last August. Before then, the Bongo family had ruled Gabon with a tight grip for more than 55 years. Ibarba said the massive turnout of politicians, civil society members, youth leaders, traditional rulers, the clergy and people living with disabilities indicates how much Gabon's citizens want freedom to express themselves without fear of harassment and want improvement in their living conditions.
Mesdames et messieurs, chers compatriotes, après la conférence nationale,
Ibarba says the ongoing dialogue should heal the wounds inflicted on the people of Gabon by the Central African state's former leaders who were more interested in power than the people they were called upon to lead. He said the dialogue should not be like previous conferences that instead gave Gabon's former leaders more powers and failed to solve the country's economic, social and political problems. Ibarba said participants in the dialogue will examine some 50,000 suggestions on how to make Gabon a better place to live in. Officials say the dialogue will propose the political, economic, and social organization of the Central African nation after the transition. In an initial timeline published by the transitional government, General Oligui was to rule for 24 months, until the holding of elections in August 2025. But Gabon's transitional government now says the dialogue will examine a draft constitution that would be approved by a referendum on a date chosen by Oligui. After that, the government would hold elections to transfer power to civilians. Opposition and civil society groups say the general invited about 100 senior military officers and about 250 people who were loyal to the ousted Bongo regime because he wants to extend his stay in power. The general and his supporters say the dialogue will set the rules for future elections and decide who can be a candidate in Gabon's presidential elections. Oligui says he will respect the resolutions of the inclusive national dialogue. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Somalia's semi-autonomous state of Puntland said it has withdrawn from the country's federal system and will govern itself independently until constitutional amendments passed by the central government in Somalia are approved in a nationwide referendum. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Abdi Ismail Samata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament, for his take on the Somalia Federation.
I was expecting it, and maybe more of the provinces would be coming along the same way, largely because the constitution was a document of consensus, and the president decided to run it on its own, and therefore that breached the agreements on which the constitution was based. So it's not surprising that Puntland has decided to get out of it.
What does this mean for the Federation of Somalia, given what even is happening in Somaliland?
I don't think the old Somali Republic is going to go into separate directions, at least not in the next few years. But it's a bad omen for the future, because in a country where the politicians had a very low level of trust among themselves, this act will simply exacerbate that and will make it even more difficult to put the country back together on the basis in which all the people of the country feel that they belong and that they have a stake in this. So it sort of undermines whatever little trust on which the current constitution was based on. But I think the Somali people, by and large, if they get the kind of right leadership they had in yesteryears, they will come back together. So I am not quite concerned about the federation becoming no more.
Despite the fact that the amendment was passed by the federal parliament, the amendment still have to go to the people for ratification. What do you expect to happen there?
Well, it's not going to go to the people for a long time because, as you know, Douglas, so much of the country is occupied by Al-Shabaab. The Somaliland issue has not been resolved. So what the president decided to do is to buy time so that 2 years from now, when he apparently is going to run for office, he wants to be the manager of the process rather than a candidate. But this constitution will not go to the people for another 10 years, in my opinion.
Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He spoke from the Somali capital, Mogadishu, with Douglas Mpuga. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A judge in Pretoria, South Africa, on Tuesday threw out a petition brought by the Speaker of Parliament to prevent her arrest on corruption and money laundering charges. The National Prosecuting Authority has accused the Speaker of soliciting bribes worth about $240,000 from a defense contractor between 2016 and 2019 when she was Minister of Defense and military veterans. Professor Sipo Sipe is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me the court ruling paved the way for the speaker's arrest, or she may have to turn herself in to the police to be charged.
The arrest would have been informed by speculation and allegations that the speaker is guilty of some form of bribery. And there's a list of instances where the speaker is accused of having accepted a bribe. And this has been in the media space. And the speaker felt that this is irregular, but also that she felt that the case against her was weak. And she wanted the protection of the court to make sure that she is not arrested, because being arrested will mean that the damage to her reputation may be irreparable. Before the judge could pronounce on the matter, the National Prosecuting Authority indicated that the speaker had not been charged, but she had jumped the gun. So the judge said, given that the NP, the National Prosecuting Authority, has not charged her, her approach to the court is based on speculation. And as a result, the judge felt that she will not be able to grant the plea. The second issue that the judge raised is that it is not for the courts to stop bodies like the National Prosecuting Authority and the police to arrest suspects. So the speaker's application was actually dismissed.
So, Professor, does this mean now that the Speaker of Parliament can now be arrested for the corruption allegations?
It definitely. What it means, it gives the National Prosecution Authority the right to proceed should they wish to arrest him. But the manner in which this will be effected, because the speaker was talking about how she's an important person, but the judge indicated that the mere fact that she has been alerted and also been told that she must present herself in a police station with a lawyer is sufficient courtesy that is given to her. But that courtesy does not amount to a right. So effectively, after that judgment, it will be up to the police or the National Prosecuting Authority to decide how they are going to effect the arrest. But what is very clear is that the court gave the National Prosecuting Authority as well as the police the right to arrest the speaker at any time that they consider fit.
The speaker is a member of the ruling African National Congress, and South Africa goes to national elections on May 29. Would this be another baggage for the ANC?
Well, it's a serious blemish because we are talking about a high-ranking person within the ANC, but also within parliament and government. She's almost set in line. If you're talking about should something happen to the president, you then have a deputy president. Should anything happen to the deputy president who would be acting, then the speaker would be next in line. So this is not a small case. It's a very serious case.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Sudanese refugees sheltering in Mabang County, South Sudan, are calling for an end to the conflict in Sudan. The refugees, who are mainly from Sudan's Blue Nile state, originally crossed into South Sudan in 2012. After the fighting erupted between the Sudan Armed Forces and the SPLM North Rebels, the refugees are calling for a ceasefire as Ramadan comes to a close. Maman Abraham Kuo reports.
For nearly 12 years, refugees from Sudan's Blue Nile state have been grappling with harsh living conditions, little food, and scarce medical services at a refugee camp in the state. 36-year-old Sally Erfa, a father of 10 children who lives at Batil refugee camp in Mabang County, says the current fighting between Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces should end so that refugees can return home.
We ask for peace. We raise our hand. We need peace. We ask youth, because youth, they are the one dying, and politicians, now they are not there on the field. We are the one suffering.
Adao Akim, another Sudanese refugee who shelters at the Kaya refugee camp, says he was happy when a number of Sudanese rebel groups signed the Juba peace agreement, but he lost hope of returning to Sudan when fighting broke out again last year in April.
We don't have any dream that we can go back to Sudan because the capital city is Detroit and other tribalism wars has entered. Now 99% of youth or people in camp, they don't feel like to go to Sudan.
For the 2-year-old Molita Kim, chairperson of refugees at Jendrasa refugee camp in Mabang County, says the warring parties should silence the guns before the end of Ramadan fasting.
Those who are fighting, we encourage for these people to call for peace, because the world strike everything in Sudan and also killed many children in Sudan. And because this is the Ramadan, people should return to sit down and discuss what brought this one to agree and make peace for people to return back to Sudan.
Hakim says he cannot forget how he and other refugees walked on foot from Sudan to South Sudan and witnessed many people die from hunger or illness. Several mediation processes have been initiated, including the Jeddah Peace Initiative, brokered by the United States, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the IGAD Quartet mediation process, as well as mediation efforts by neighboring South Sudan. So far, none of those efforts has been successful. According to the International Organization for Migration, approximately 10.7 million people are displaced as a result of the Sudan conflict, including 9 million internally displaced people. For VOA News, I am Amira Bramquart, reporting from Boone, Mabon County.
White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby says the U.S. was outraged over the Israeli airstrike that killed 7 workers with a Washington-based charity, and he called on Israel to do more to ensure civilians and humanitarian aid workers are protected. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane reports from the State Department.
The World Central Kitchen Aid Group, which feeds people suffering due to natural disasters and wars, says it has suspended operations in Gaza after an Israeli airstrike hit its convoy as it was leaving a warehouse loaded with food. A U.S. official confirmed a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen was among the 7 killed. The armored cars carrying food were clearly branded with the WCK logo. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby had this reaction during Tuesday's press briefing.
We were outraged to learn of an IDF strike that killed a number of civilian humanitarian workers yesterday from the World Central Kitchen, which has been relentless in working to get food to those who are hungry in Gaza and, quite frankly, around the world.
World Central Kitchen is run by celebrity chef Jose Andres. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said President Joe Biden reached out to Andres.
The president conveyed he is grieving with the entire World Central Kitchen family. The president felt it was important to recognize the tremendous contribution World Central Kitchen has made to the people in Gaza and people around the world. The president conveyed he will make clear to Israel that humanitarian aid workers must be protected.
Standing with his French counterpart on a visit to Paris, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called the aid workers heroes who must be protected.
We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, and impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened.
French Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourné was more direct in condemning the Israeli strike. He said, "Allow me first of all to express our strong condemnation of the Israeli strike that led to the deaths of 7 humanitarian workers from the NGO World Central Kitchen. Protecting humanitarian workers is a moral and legal imperative that everyone must adhere to." Israel's military on Tuesday expressed sincere sorrow over the airstrike and said officials are reviewing the incident at the highest levels. Relief experts say Palestinian children and families are on the brink of starvation, and this attack will only make things worse. The war between Israel and Hamas began last October 7th when Hamas militants stormed into southern Israel, killing some 1,200 people. Israel has responded with a 6-month-old offensive, killing some 33,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry. Cindy Sane, VOA News, the State Department.
And that's it for this Wednesday, April 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Botting, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.